All right, we're in IE World again. Hi, Dean.
Hey, Charles.
How you doing? It's great to be here again.
It's a great day in IE. I'd like to introduce you to Jason Upton.
Hey, Charles. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm great.
Never met you before. Yeah. What's your story?
Test manager. Been working on Windows for quite a while. I was a director of test on Windows Vista and XPSP2 and Server 2003.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. Nice big products, and I kind of wanted to get down to something that'd be really fun. And this browser thing I hear is going to be pretty big someday, this internet. So I thought it'd be pretty cool to come over and work on this.
Absolutely. So before we jump into like sort of the test experience of a browser, which I think is a pretty interesting story, let's just kind of dive in. Last time we were here, we were talking about privacy.
Privacy's big.
Exactly, sort of a series of interviews with you. And today it's RC1, which is huge. What exactly does that mean? I mean, what's going on?
Hey, so let's be clear about what RC is, okay. And I'll tell you why it's huge. The release candidate of Internet Explorer 8 is available for download today. It's available across 25 languages and a variety of flavors of Windows. The exact flavors are
XP, Server 2003, XP X64 editions, Windows Vista, and Windows Server 2008.
Okay. Now, the really big deal of a release candidate is that it's the end of beta.
Okay.
And, you know, it's actually great to go up to Wikipedia. I went up last night to read about, I just looked for software beta. This nice article that, you know, gives the origin of the term.
Mm-hmm.
Betas are about intensive feedback loop. People try stuff, they give you the feedback, and wow, we've gotten a lot of feedback. And we've acted on a lot of feedback.
Mm-hmm.
But the release candidate marks the end of beta.
Okay.
Not the end of listening, but the end of beta. And with a release candidate, we're saying the product behaves the way you should expect the final product to behave. So it's developers, consumers, IT managers, enterprise guys, start your engines. Go in, try it out. And we're still listening for feedback. We're listening very critically for what's classically called showstopper feedback. I'm not sure if you have any other, you know, good lingo for that.
I love those showstoppers. No, I mean, we're pretty sure the thing is solid, and you know, unless everybody goes out and sort of takes it for a test drive, we can't be super sure. So we're certainly doing it. You know, I'm running it at home. My wife's running it. I've got a bunch of friends that are running it, and it's great. Like, I get great feedback. I got a feedback from a friend of mine who runs a web development company, and he's like, "Wow, it's great! Like, it's so fast, and it's got this and that." It gave me all kinds of good feedback on the features, and so. I'm just happy people like it.
So you've got the 10 PCs you've got at home.
Yeah.
But then we also have about 10 to the 7th, right? Say 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th, 10 to the 8th. We've got about 10 to the 7th sockets out there running IE8, giving us feedback. We have this amazing telemetry loop.
I bet.
You know, measurement at a distance. So, you know, every time IE crashes or hangs, someone on Jason's team gets a small electrical shock. And, you know, we respond very seriously to those because we don't like seeing that data come in. And there's been fixes and analysis. I mean, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I had a pretty interesting one the other day. We were going through this one particular crash, and in fact, I spent like 2 hours yesterday just going through crash data, and then it was. It just kind of seemed like a normal, like, oh, okay, this person's doing this sort of odd thing in this control. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that this was on, like, a top 2 website.
Uh-oh.
And it was in kind of a standard path. And it looks like, wow, we really probably need to look at that. And it turns out it's actually a problem with the control, which does happen. You know, it's software, too, and software's hard. And so we talked to the vendor, and the vendor says, yep, we're rolling out a fix for it. We know about it, too. And so they're rolling out a fix, and... But it's great. Without that data, we don't know how bad the problem is. We don't know if it's our problem or somebody else's problem. And so it helps us just make the web a better place.
Excellent. Now, I mean, with that data, I mean, a question would be, what were some of the most common problems that the beta was having that you noticed? I mean, was there sort of a...
Yeah, I would say that the most common feedback we got from the beta sites was really around site layout. Like, you know, these bullet points are supposed to be in a straight line, you know, and they're kind of off a little bit. Like, we'll have that, or this text is overlapped with this other text, or, you know, layout problems on the page, placement problems. Those were a problem in Beta 2 in various places. Beta 2 was pretty solid, but we knew we had some bugs in our CSS engine. And we knew we weren't quite complete. You know, we had a couple things we had still to do after Beta 2. And we've done a ton of that work now. We're pretty much at the point where we think we're done with CSS.
Wow.
Our implementation, there could be bugs, but that's why we're doing our release candidate and make sure everybody gives us feedback if there's something like really wrong, we need to know quickly. Mm-hmm. And with that, then we can go out there and the web can really get ready for a standards compliant IE.
Excellent. Now, what about performance and reliability? We've talked about security and stuff like that. Let's talk about performance.
Okay, so, you know, reliability, unbelievably important. Nobody wants to crash when they're browsing the web because the sites that you look at are very important to you.
Sure.
Right? Performance has a lot of different aspects to it, right? And mm-hmm. there's performance. As we talk with different people, they totally light up about different parts of performance. A lot of people get very fixated on what I'll call the drag race. Mm-hmm. Hi, here's a site, and when I go to it, it'll produce a bar graph of all the different browsers that I go to at the site, and I can feel like I'm wearing a white lab coat, and I'm an engineer, and mm-hmm. I get a graph. And that's laboratory performance. And it's interesting, because if all you do all day is run script, mm-hmm. that's a totally realistic way to look at performance. Real people on real sites have a very different experience, because the sites they go to aren't just script. They're a combination of HTML and CSS and script and XML HTTP requests and a bunch of other technologies. And what we found from talking to real people is that they're much more focused on, well, what happens when I go to the sites that I go to? And, you know, looking at, you know, going to a webmail site, you know, looking at Outlook Web Access or Hotmail or Gmail or going to Amazon or CNN. When you look at those side-by-sides, you know, performance is, you know, there are sites where IE8's faster and there are sites where other browsers are faster. And overall, I found it's mostly a push. And what have you found?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of look at it the same way that I think the way I kind of think of it is the, you know, you get the car driver or something, you flip it open and you go, wow, you know, I want to see, here's the Mustang versus Corvette shoot off or shootout. And you look at it and, you know, you flip to the last page and figure out which one did they pick. And you look at the 0 to 60 numbers and the braking distance and all of these, you know, lateral acceleration, all these fun numbers. But, you know, if you walk into the dealership and you sit down and you put your elbow down, you're like, wow, that's just pretty uncomfortable. Like, my arm doesn't fit good there. And your can of pop falls over in the cup holder. And just things just aren't right in this one versus that one because it fits better for you. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, to me, that's the difference. Like, it has to be, yes, it has to have the performance that you want in certain aspects. But, you know, some people look at that as battery lifetime or miles per gallon, and some people look at that as 0 to 60 acceleration, but it's really kind of the combination of all those things that makes a great product. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I look at performance and reliability both.
So that's a great point.
And the other bit on performance is there's performance for the machine and there's performance for me. And what I find for performance for me is I'll be in the middle of a mail message and I'll be like, wow, I wonder how I spell that guy's name, or there's been something in the news, and I want to make sure I get the reference right. I can go up to the search box, and I can start typing, and, you know, I'll get nice suggestions, and I'll get visual suggestions, and depending on which provider I'm at, I can get really good stuff. I go up to Amazon, I type in iPod or Zune, I can see prices and exact model numbers, and it's very easy for me to get very fast access to the information that I want. I'm in the middle of writing a mail message and wondering, oh, I wonder what traffic's like on the way home. I'll have a slice on my favorites bar, and I'll just be able to see right away mm-hmm. what's going on with traffic. I'll get a piece of mail from Jason, and I'll wonder, wow, it's an address. I wonder where that is. You know, with an accelerator, I get super fast access to a map that'll give me, you know, what's going on there. And so there's the performance of the code.
Sure.
But the performance of the code serves not the machine, but it's supposed to be serving the user,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the user's sitting there trying to get stuff done, and the ability for users, for the people who are browsing the web, to have, you know, a quicker time through their common tasks, you know, the way real people really browse the web, that's huge. Mm-hmm. That's just absolutely huge.
Absolutely. So on Channel 9 and all over the internet, I mean, it's always consistently, and we've had this conversation many times, mm-hmm. about CSS standards and mm-hmm. compliance, and we had that. What I thought was really exciting when you passed the ACID II test, I thought that was a rather amazing accomplishment given our history. Can we talk a little bit about that? I mean, how is, you know, IE8 finally, like, what's the word on? Are we going to be standards compliant, right? I mean, I know that's, it's sort of a strange question, but I just always see that on Channel 9.
I think it's a great question. And the question is, so there's a CSS spec. Mm-hmm. It's about yay thick, right, depending on how you want to print it out. It's about yay thick.
Okay.
And the question is, well, do you pass or not? And, you know, you can start on page one and go, do we do that? The way that modern software works, real modern software, is you have a specification,
mm-hmm.
you have an implementation, right, that's now old world, specification implementation, and you have a test. And, you know, Jason didn't work on IE7. Jason was, you know, busy making Windows great, core Windows great. But the introduction of the test suite is a huge, huge step forward. I mean, you should, you know, I think that your engineering background is probably a good...
Yeah, it's very, I mean, I came from kind of the audio multimedia background. And,
okay.
You know, we used some of these interesting bench tools, you know, these audio test benches, and you're looking at signal to noise ratio and total harmonic distortion and all of these interesting things, trying to figure out, like, are we adding glitches and ticks and pops to the sound channel and that kind of stuff. And those are all really interesting, but unless you really know what you're after, you don't know where you sit. So you can say, wow, well, you know, most humans can't perceive, you know, more or less than this total harmonic distortion, or and so you go, okay, well, how does that work to the relate to the web world? Mm-hmm. Well, here's the CSS standard, and this is how pages are supposed to lay out. And it's ambiguous because what you hear and what I hear is different, just because the spec there is ambiguous as well, but how it sounds. You know, there's a difference. There's no difference when I play a CD back between a $100 stereo and a $100,000 home theater setup. But there's a pretty substantial difference when you're sitting there listening to it. Same thing is true here, right? You can go in and you can implement some stuff in a spec, and yes, you know, this green box overlaps this red box or something like that. But, you know, do all those tests kind of flow together? If each one of those individual pieces work, then how are they assembled together, and is it a good overall web development experience and rendering experience in the browser? And ultimately, you know, do those pages work in more than just one browser? And that's something that we really want to make sure happens is, you know, can this thing work well here, and so the web developer doesn't have to go and jump through 47 different hoops to get it working on this one, and then 45 hoops to get it working on that one. We really want the layout to be very consistent between these pages.
Absolutely.
I think it's huge to have a test suite where you can go through and say, look, this is what it means to pass CSS 2.1, to be compliant. There are this many thousand tests. And you can go through and say, you know, instead of arguing about what a word means, you can just say, look, there are this many thousand tests, and we pass this many, and we don't pass that many. Now, we've been open to feedback from people in the community, but we've posted these tests, and we've changed a bunch of tests based on feedback we got through the beta. Mm. And the whole point is that there is, you know, there is this objective, yep, go run this. And we donated the W3C under all the right licensing that the W3C wants. And again, we took a bunch of feedback. So to me, getting that kind of, yep, it's, you know, it's a black or white. It's mm-hmm. it's true or false. We've passed this test. Yeah, we're kind of CSS,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, we have CSS 2.1 compliance by the suite. The interesting thing is going to be when the committee actually passes it, because the patient is still open, in some words, right? They can still edit the spec. So the test suite and the product are a moment in time right now. You know, stepping back from CSS and the test suite, I think one thing that's really important for anyone who's, you know, survived 10 minutes and, you know, got
this
video.
They always survive these videos.
I want to use a three-letter acronym, the call to action, the CTA.
Okay.
So Jason is the person responsible for quality on Internet Explorer 8. Like, what do you want people to do now that the RC's out?
The big thing is just really go through and, you know, put on your user hat. Go to the websites that you like, log into your bank, check your balance, go, you know, play around, and just make sure that your web works. That's super important. As an end user, we want as many people doing that as possible. That's why we do a public beta. We make sure it's out there, and people can give us good feedback. We have a report a web page problem add-on that we can add in. Users can go up there, and any user can go add it on to IE8RC. send feedback on the particular website, say, oh, this site doesn't look right, or this is a problem, or that's a problem, and we can act on that feedback. But the other thing is as a web developer and, you know, a tools developer, web services developer, or ActiveX control developer, toolbar, any of those, just use it, play around with it, run through all of your interesting test cases, test 64-bit, test 32-bit, test intranet zone, internet zone, all of these interesting cases that come up. You know, a common problem I run into just, you know, as a user is I go to somebody's checkout page. Ran into this the other day, and you go to check out on something, and you get this prompt that says, oh, well, some of this content's not secure, and indeed it's not. Like, it's coming from an HTTP server, and it could take your information, and I don't want it to take my information. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty easy bug for a website to go through and fix. All they have to have done is checked out once. And so that's something that, you know, we really want people to go do with the RC as web developers and test developers in these various companies, because it's super important for customers to have a great user experience.
Absolutely. Now, as far as user experience, I think it's probably fair to say that a significant number of crashes that happen, and I'm not talking just about a tab, I'm talking about the whole base application, mm-hmm. Is because of add-ons, right? Maybe they're written in C++, it's native code, it's easy to corrupt memory, it's easy to do something wrong.
Com dispatches, and
you got it.
Class factories and all that fun stuff.
So have you done anything? I mean, is there anything that you can do to help, like, prevent somebody writing, you know, bad com from taking down the whole application? It's a super hard problem, but I mean, what kind of new sort of stability?
It is a super hard problem. And there's a few different ways to slice it up. And one way we did it is, you know, we see a lot of controls on specific pages that crash. And, you know, that it's hard, right? It's really hard to write great code. And, you know, whether that's JavaScript code or C++ code, it's hard to do. And your people are going to make mistakes. So when they do, we'd rather them not take the whole browser out. If I have one tab that's, you know, logged into my bank and the other one I happen to be watching, you know, YouTube videos or something, like, I don't want the video to crash the bank, and I don't want the bank to crash the video. And by isolating those tabs, and if something does happen in some of that software, it'll take down just that tab, and the rest of the browser's up and running.
Okay.
And the process isolation work we did that came out in beta 2, mm-hmm. it was very, wow, this was hard science, right, to go through and figure out how to make the iframe on the outside separated from all the different tabs so that you can have a YouTube video playing here and you're listening to it, and then this tab goes down and comes back up, and you can just keep crashing this one. Go into Task Manager and do that. The process isolation was really, really hard and really cool. Mm-hmm. And we shipped that in beta 2. And it was exciting to get feedback from folks around the boundary cases and the scenarios where it didn't work as expected. And we've done a bunch of fixes around, you know, browsing to more than 78 sites as they, you know, drop cookies.
Yep.
For example, there's some very interesting boundary cases we ran into. A lot of reliability data that fed our coding.
Excellent.
And sending that feedback, you know, we see, I'll still run across somebody every once in a while that, you know, gets the little pop-up and they say, don't send. And that just pains me because, you know, I specifically look for that feedback and look through it. And we can't act on a fix. We can't go talk to a third-party vendor that says, oh, I just run this control on this kids' site. You know, it's just a bunch of kids' games. Well, some of those kids' games are pretty high volume, and they really don't have a great user experience if they're crashing all the time on there. Mm-hmm. Whether that's an IE experience or, you know, any other experience. Like, nobody wants to do that. That's sort of I think of those as quality events, right? Like, you don't want to be surprised by a product, you know, whether that's software, hardware, you know, your car. You know, when I put my key in my ignition in my car and I turn it, wow, if it doesn't start, that's a quality event. Like, it makes me think that I'm running a lower quality product.
Absolutely.
And so you don't want those sorts of experiences, regardless of who wrote the code. Mm-hmm. And so sending that feedback allows us to get that to whoever wrote the code. They can make changes to it, and the web can just improve.
Now, you can see some examples of this. With IE8, and like I took a machine and I just tried to run it for a while without IE8 just so we could get kind of broken in from our usual websites. Mm-hmm. Like from zero up to standard Vista, up through browsing around a while and collecting controls and things, and then putting IE8 on it. And on first startup, i8 warned me about all the extensions I had that were out of date. It was pretty exciting. Like, we'd go through and we'd say, "Whoa, you've got an old version of this, and you've got an old." Can I say names, or you?
You can use some names if you want.
I could use some
Microsoft
names,
maybe that.
It's like, oh, you've got an old version of the Windows Live sign in login helper thing, or oh, you've got an ancient version of Skype, okay. Or you've got whatever. So, you know, you've got these things, and instead of having IE run through and crash, there's a prompt up front that just says, "Look, we know this is out of date. You can check for a new update or just keep going, and we'll turn this thing off." Now, that's an example where the folks who ran the beta, because they sent us their data, right? That was absolutely huge. Then we could go through and work with those, you know, with those other teams, mm-hmm. and figure out, wow, you've got this issue. Let's get a newer version now. Because it represents not just a quality event from reliability, mm-hmm. but also represents a potential security issues, because, you know, security and crashing are very close to each other.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the S word, and I know you guys have done a ton of work around security.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly you found security bugs in beta and you fixed them for RC1, and that's definitely a priority. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to call you. I mean, you said S.
Well, let me dig in a little bit on S, and you can go where you want. I think about safety, and safety's got a few flavors to it. There's definitely security. Mm-hmm. When I go to sites, I only want the code that I want to run. No one gets to run code on my machine unless it's okay with me, kind of model. That's security.
Sure.
Ton of work around security. That's super important. But really being safe involves a bunch of other things. Am I at the site that I think I'm at? So top-level domain highlighting. You can look up in the address bar and see what domain you're really at. There's a recent Twitter issue where some people were kind of thought they might kind of be at Twitter, but weren't really kind of at Twitter. And folks who are running i8 didn't have that problem because they could look up the address bar and go, wow, that's not twitter.com.
Hmm.
Top-level domain highlighting is big. Phishing filter from i7 is better. The malware filter is huge. Right, I'm at the site, and yeah, you know, maybe my nephew wants to download a screensaver from this site onto my kitchen PC where he's browsing. And you know what? I don't want that because that is a known piece of malware. And i8 can protect against that.
Right.
The cross-site scripting filter is huge. I could go on because it's not just what people think of as security, like a 0 to 60 security drag race, but it's the overall experience. And, you know, privacy is huge. I mean, we talked about privacy even during planning. I mean, how do you feel about it now?
Yeah, no, I'm so happy with the privacy work we've done in this product. Like, you just look around the web and you know, all of a sudden I'm seeing things that I don't expect on pages, and you know, I'm sitting there running along in private mode and in private browsing mode, and I know that stuff's not going to those sites. I'm very happy with that. I'm also really happy that people are really in control of where they're sending that data,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's something that previous IEs hasn't offered. So
let me ask a question about that, because in private is really, really interesting, and I know it created a little bit of a can of worms last time when it first was
excitement.
Announced. Excitement, excuse me. What's new with in private, and further, you know, what's wrong with the notion of perhaps running in private by default?
Okay.
Why do I have manually say I want these to be in private?
These are great questions. So when it comes to let's start with running it by default.
Yeah.
So I just got back from the Consumer Electronics Show. I was in Las Vegas last week.
Cool.
And there's a joke you can only use when you're demoing in Las Vegas, which is, you know, here's i8, mm-hmm. and I'm browsing along, and I can type in the address bar, and here's all the sites I've been to already. And that's great. And now over here's IE8 in private browsing. And it's Vegas mode, because where you browse in private stays in private, right? And it's great. So on the one hand, it's super useful in a bunch of scenarios. Like, there's a demo machine,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to check my email. I didn't want my email to mess up the history and displace things so that the person who then comes in from some important magazine sees where I've been.
Sure.
So in private browsing, or, you know, Jason comes over to my house and he wants to check some stuff on the web and not leave any tracks. Okay, so in private browsing is great. I don't want to browse in private by default, because then I can't get back to the sites I've been to. Right, so there's a good reason why I browse regular.
Sure.
Most of the time. In private filtering, is really, you know, again, as people get their heads around, I go to different sites on the web, and there are sites that I don't know I'm visiting, that my machine is visiting. Mm-hmm. And every time you visit something, you leak information.
Certainly.
And so who has a line of sight, and who's in position to create a profile of my browsing? Now, that was an exciting feature when we released it in Beta 2, and we took a ton of feedback about it. And the biggest changes mostly revolved around balancing the feedback that we got from different groups. So, for example, there were some folks who said, wow, your threshold is 10. There's a site over there that's seen me across 10 other sites. And they're like, well, you know, I want it to be higher than 10, and you know, that guy wants it to be lower than 10. So, you know, now there's control, and you can go through and say, I want it to be higher or lower.
Okay.
There's a much more explicit welcome page, so that when you turn on in-private filtering, you really get to understand, look, as you browse the web, here's what happens to your information, and it's neither good nor bad. Mm-hmm. It just is. But since you're the user and you're in control, you can decide to go through and filter this information flow in this way. That's the short version of the changes.
Great. So I guess a question that's also, I think, useful is, as I mean, we're at 2009 now.
Yes.
We're at version 8 of Internet Explorer. I mean, at some point, the consistent debate that a lot of the sort of, you know, the vocal crowd out there will have needs to become less and less important to you, and you need to concentrate on features. And that's sort of what you've done, right? And what I mean by that is, not less important to you, but we always have this conversation, IE versus Firefox. Firefox does this faster. Firefox renders this better. No, IE renders that better. But what about just the basic features of the browser, right? Your analogy of the car was excellent. But the basic structure and componentry of almost all automobiles is similar, right? And you don't worry about, you know, the core parts of the engine, the core parts of the system. It's the shell. It's the user experience, stuff like that. Now, you've done a lot of work with UI. That's the kind of rambling question I'm getting to. Can we talk about the new UI, the new features that
Yeah, so it's interesting because some people think they get paid by the pixel, right? Like, if I haven't introduced more pixels of user interface or moved the current pixels around, I haven't done my job, right? And that's a really bad mental model.
Sure.
I think the much better mental model is, what are real people doing on the web every day, right? You take 500 million people, they browse a lot. You know, as Jason said, this web thing might be really big one day. What are they doing over and over and over again? And we started from data around what people do, and then we worked up to a feature set. And that feature set really reflects how real people browse. And it starts from real people navigate. And they work with tabs, and they're trying to get back to sites they've been to. Mm-hmm. So there are really big things and really little things that together make that act of navigating a lot better. You know, for example, people go, oh yeah, I search a lot on the web. You know, a lot of the time that I'm searching to get back to a place I've already been to. So you type in the search box, and you start typing, oh man, there's this article in the New York Times about this pizzeria that sounded really cool, and I get a chance to go to New York, and I start typing New York pizza. It'll show me hits out of my local history.
Cool.
Because I don't want to go off and do a big web search to come back to this URL that's already somewhere in my machine. Right? I can go back and get to that site easily. Or you know, one of my favorite examples, you know, when I was going off and showing IE7, when we were about to release IE7, I was talking with someone and you know, they close a tab and then they're talking to me and they go, I really did not mean to do that. Can I just get that back? So, you know, it's great to have a command that undo tab close, right? That would be nice. Like, Jason and I will remember Control-Shift-T. But, you know, if a feature falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, is it really a feature? Mm-hmm. So doing things that make the functionality in flow for the user. So when you go to the new tab page, right there, here are all the tabs I've ever had opened. Right, I can easily go back to any of the things I've had in the session. Where if you close IE, and then you go, I didn't mean to click through and say close all those tabs. Next time you start IE, you can easily restore the previous session. Right, so it really starts from what people do, and they navigate, and they manipulate their tabs. Or grouping. I mean, we know that people have got multiple tabs open at once. They're not all related. So, you know, I've got my webmail, and I've got my search going, and I've got my my, you know, reading the news with articles. And as I open tabs from each of these, IE groups them and IE colors them. So I can just look up and go, yep, those, you know, the yellow ones are the ones from, you know, reading the Wall Street Journal today, and the green ones are the ones that came from doing a web search.
Great.
And the sun colored one, that's my mail. And the thing that you're describing, which is, well, what do I win as a user, mm-hmm. right? We are so driven by you know, how do people really use it? We've got this amazing tradition that goes back 20 years from, like, the first usability lab to the two-way glass, mm-hmm. and the hundreds of hours of videotape of, you know, yeah. usability feedback we have. And what's been the biggest surprise?
And I would add, the other thing is, you know, again, back to the feedback. Mm-hmm. So beta sites give us feedback on things that work and don't work, but also we have the customer improvement program that you can add into Windows, you know, can opt into in Windows, and that gives us a bunch of that feedback. You know, we can see, like, how many times does somebody click back in a tab, and how many times do they go re-navigate a new tab back to a known good URL. And so a lot of that information that is in the new tab page today came directly from that feedback of users using IE7 and tabs, and how do they interact with it, and what do they do, so that it is, it allows us to put it really in flow. You know, there's not this sort of, again, kind of a quality event. There's not this jarring, like, oh, I got to go to a menu for that, or it's just kind of, oh, well, it's just, I just keep my hand moving. I click here, I click there, I click there, and I get where I want to go.
No, I mean, you don't know about Alt-Shift-F9? If you knew about Alt-Shift-F9, your world would change.
Exactly.
All right. I don't know if even my mom has watched all the way through this part of
I'm
the
sure
video.
She has.
You know, I bet Scoble has. I don't know about my mom. So if we're going to have one last question that you think represents the spirit and soul of Channel 9 mm-hmm. folk, what would it be?
What would it be?
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, I mean, I sort of alluded to it around the... I will. Here we go. Channel 9 is mostly composed of developers or people who are interested in how things work. So I guess it could be a two-part question. As far as platform is concerned, mm-hmm. right, IE has really always been a platform, right? I mean, it is. We created DHTML. I mean, how has it improved from IE7 to IE8 as a platform would be one question. And the other question would be architecturally, Internet Explorer itself as a complex piece of software. How has its architecture perhaps improved when you think about, say, Windows 2000 to Windows 7 from an operating system perspective? Clearly, there's lots of changes in the kernel and the shell and whatnot. What kind of changes have happened in IE? So, I mean, these are big, giant questions. You don't have to hit them. Like,
all right, so I promise that the answer won't be complete, but I'll try to fly over the surface, right? I'll take the platform one, and you take the architectural integrity one, because I was a math major, and you were a real engineering major, so you're qualified to talk about
that. Hey, I was a math major, too. Man, rock on.
From a platform point of view, mm-hmm. again, very high-altitude answer. I think that we started from what developers really care about. And we heard a lot of feedback around dev tooling. And I think we have excellent dev tooling built into the product at this point that will help real developers write their real sites. We understand they care about interoperability, right? They don't want to have to write the same site every time, over and over, for each different browser. And mm-hmm. so the interoperability is absolutely huge. And the test suite is really, you know, how you codify that interoperability. Those two things are important. The whipped cream and cherry on top on the platform mm-hmm. is all the stuff that you can do in IE8 that you couldn't do before. And, you know, whether it's XDR, cross-domain request stuff that we've blogged about and
sure.
shipped, or the connection events, an offline store. Like, to me, those are huge. I'll go back to the demo from MixO8. I'm at a site, I yank the network cable out, and the send button turns into a save button. I didn't lose my work. And it's not like I'm just sitting there in the browser and, you know, the cafe's router went down and I hit send and poof, I lose data. Like, the site can be intelligent and responsive.
Excellent.
To that. And as a platform, end-to-end, it's, you know, the innovation, the interoperability, and the ability to have good tooling so that developers can get their jobs done. That's a huge difference from 7 to 8. And, you know, at the same time, there's also compatibility, right? Like, if you did all your work in 7, hey, add this meta tag and you're all set in 8. So from a platform point of view, I think that's the high-altitude flyover. Architecturally?
Cool. So I would say architecturally, I mean, the two biggies are really the process isolation stuff that we talked about a little bit earlier. You know, being able to have this tab on you know, in the intranet zone, running at a different integrity level that allows me to do some things that maybe I can't do or don't want to do on the internet. I have some code running on my machine that I wouldn't necessarily expect to trust over the internet. And I can have that thing that, you know, I had some guy I worked with 5 years ago put this website together, and it's not CSS 2.1 compliant. It's not CSS anything compliant, really. You know, it's a bunch of random collection of stuff that he put together. So I can run that in IE7 mode on the intranet, and it works great in compatibility view. And yet I can go to a website that's totally CSS 2.1 compliant, and I can run it. And architecturally, that's possible through really two rendering engines. We have the new layout engine that's this very robust, sort of built from the ground up architecture, and that allows us to do things like CSS 2.1 and beyond. And then we have the older sort of quirks engine, if you will, the IE sort of 5, 6, 7 mode engine, and that allows us to have great compatibility. And the web developer or the user can choose. The web developer can say, hey, you know what, I'm just going to keep this in 7 mode until I'm ready, and whenever Microsoft ships their browser, they ship it, and my site's good, and then when I want to upgrade it to some standard site, I can, or I don't have to if I don't want to. It's up to me. The end user can say, wow, you know what? I really like the way this thing used to look. I don't like the way it looks now. I can push this compatibility view button, and I can get back to that mode. So everybody's in control of their experience, and that's really only possible through a really extensive architectural change in IE.
Absolutely. Well, it's really an amazing piece of software. It's very complex.
Thanks for coming by. I really appreciate it. Do you want to say hi to the family? I mean, you know.
No. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad.
So we briefly touched on him and what he does. I mean, you're the director of tests, so you're responsible for ensuring the quality of IE, and you have a team of testers underneath you, and you come from Windows.
I do.
All right. Anything else
in
you
Minnesota.
Want? I mean,
Minnesota before Windows.
Minnesota before Windows. Yes. You've been at Microsoft for a while.
13 years. Yep.
Nice. Well, hey, excellent job, and congratulations, you guys, to another, you know, big-time release.
Thanks, Charles.
Thanks.
Cheers.